From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today on Democracy Now!, the United Nations Truth Commission in Guatemala finds the United States responsible for genocide. Also, civil rights leaders call for a meeting with President Clinton as they demand a national investigation of police brutality. All that and more here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Sitting in for Amy Goodman, I'm Laura Flanders. First, these headlines. A U.S. airstrike damaged a pipeline in northern Iraq and halted the flow of oil, an Iraqi oil ministry official said yesterday. American officials denied the charge. Iraq, though, said the strike hit a pumping station, killing one Iraqi and seriously wounding two others. According to the Pentagon, earlier Sunday, U.S. fighter jets attacked Iraqi military installations after planes patrolling their U.S. and British-imposed no-fly zone over northern Iraq came under fire. In Turkey, an official speaking on condition of anonymity at an oil terminal in the Turkish port Kihan said the attack hit energy transmission lines of a communications center that operates the pipeline, stopping the flow of oil. In Nigeria, former General Olusegun Obasanjo has been elected president, paving the way for the return of a civilian leader to Africa's most populous nation after 15 years of military rule. Still, voter fraud and other electoral irregularities cast a shadow on the elections. Aides to former finance minister Olu Fale, Obasanjo's opponent, said Fale would contest the results. The controversy, which includes charges of ballot box stuffing and other offenses, did not immediately spark public protests. Obasanjo captured 63% of the ballots in Saturday's vote, according to Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission, Chief Justice Ephraim Akpata. Fearing a second round of fighting between Israel and Lebanese guerrillas, tens of thousands of civilians took cover on both sides of the border today. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright called for restraint after Israel on Sunday made some of its biggest airstrikes in years against southern Lebanon in return for Hezbollah attacks that killed an Israeli general and six other soldiers in the Israeli-occupied zone of that country last week. In Jerusalem, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu briefed senior ministers on the situation and told them that, quote, the army is poised to continue to fight against terrorist forces in Lebanon, according to a cabinet statement. The statement did not specify if more airstrikes are to follow. Sunday's attacks renewed the debate in Israel over how to end the 17-year occupation of southern Lebanon. An international treaty to ban landmines, which kill and maim some 25,000 people each year, entered into force today. The treaty, concluded in Ottawa in 1997, has been signed by 133 countries and ratified by 64 of them. But major users and producers, including the United States, Russia, and China, have refused to join in. And even with the treaty, it will still take decades to clear the tens of millions of mines currently scattered in more than 60 countries, underlining the problems. Two children were killed and six others seriously wounded when a landmine exploded in northern Rwanda, Rwandan radio reported today. Well, AP describes it as a clash with Chinese leaders, but also reports that Secretary of State Madeleine Albright has told the Chinese that the Clinton administration will not punish Beijing for cracking down on dissidents by holding up negotiations on China joining the World Trade Organization. At a joint news conference with Chinese Foreign Minister Tang Shuan, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright said, "We determined some time ago that it was not a good idea to link human rights and trade, and that we actually make better progress when they are not linked." Doctors, scientists, and veterans advocates will be meeting again today in Atlanta to talk about Gulf War Syndrome. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is sponsoring the three-day conference. The hope is that participants will be able to come up with recommendations for future research on the still unexplained maladies that have struck thousands of soldiers who served in the Persian Gulf War. A previous congressional probe concluded that exposure to pesticides, smoke from oil well fires, and other toxins may be behind the illnesses, which range from chronic joint pain to fatigue and memory loss. But the government says it has yet to find evidence of a clear cause that could lead researchers to find remedies. Two Aborigines from Australia's Stolen Generation opened a historic court case in Darwin today, seeking damages from the government for being forcibly removed from their parents and raised as whites. Should Lorna Kubilo and Peter Gunner succeed in the federal court, it would boost 700 Stolen Generation Aborigines also seeking damages from the government and 30,000 others who could take legal action. A 1997 Australian Human Rights Commission report found a past assimilation policy of taking mixed-blood Aboriginal children from their parents to be raised on church missions or in white families was a form of genocide, and that victims should be compensated. The report listed physical and sexual abuse inflicted between the 1980s and the late 1960s on tens of thousands of Aborigines. You're listening to Democracy Now!
There is no silence deep enough.
There is no silence deep enough.
No corruption thick enough. No politician bent enough. To bury your story, to keep it from us. Love from a short distance.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, what Amy Goodman would call the exception to the rule. Amy is away on assignment. I'm Laura Flanders sitting in this week. And we're going to talk right now about a much-anticipated report that was made public last week, Guatemala's Independent Historical Clarification Commission's report, which concluded that the United States gave money and training to a Guatemalan military that committed acts of genocide against the country's Mayan population during the most brutal armed conflict in Central America. The report of the commission contradicts years of official denials of the torture, kidnapping, and execution of thousands of civilians in a conflict that the commission estimated killed over 200,000 people. The commission, which was set up as part of a United Nations-supervised peace accord that ended the conflict back in 1996, concluded that the Guatemalan government or allied paramilitaries were responsible for more than 90% of the 42,000 human rights violations, 29,000 of which ended in death or disappearances. The commission doesn't name any of the perpetrators. It did, however, list the American training of the officer corps in counterinsurgency techniques as a key factor which had significant bearing on human rights violations during the armed confrontation, as they put it. The findings on the U.S. role in the conflict are based on once secret files provided to the commission by the U.S. government itself, at least in part. We'll hear about more about that in a moment. And it's a cooperation some are saying should set a precedent for similar investigations in other countries, especially in Latin America. Well, we have with us here in the studio Alan Nairn, who is a freelance journalist and an activist who has written extensively on Guatemala and exposed much of the CIA's involvement. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Alan.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Listeners will know you as somebody who has been tracking this history for years. No need for a historical clarification when it comes to your reporting. How does this commission report stand up in contrast or in light of the evidence as you understand it or the situation as you know it?
Well, I haven't seen the full text of the report yet, just the summary. The fact that they mentioned the U.S. As having responsibility, the fact that they called it a genocide, that's good. The U.N. Truth Commission on El Salvador, for example, did an excellent job documenting the responsibility of Salvadoran generals, but they specifically avoided mention of the U.S. Role. When I asked the commissioners for Salvador after they released their report why, they said they were told that that was politically off limits. So it's good that they made this general statement. We'll see if they give the detail yet, though, because the U.S. role was really complete responsibility. The United States, from top to bottom, was arming, training, financing the military desk squad operations. They even had North American CIA operatives working inside the G2 military intelligence, which was coordinating the assassinations and the disappearances.
Now, what, as far as you understand it, has been the response of the U.S. official, the U.S. administration's responsible? I understand that they, too, are saying they haven't seen the full report, but what has been the nature of their response?
Well, I don't think they've said much yet. They don't have much to fear. If we had a functioning political system and a judicial system, those U.S. officials would have the same fear that Pinochet now has, that they would be brought to justice, but they're not facing that. If you go back and look at the record, it couldn't be more thoroughly documented. In 1954, the CIA invaded Guatemala, overthrew a democratically elected government, put the military in power. In 1963-64, the U.S. set up throughout Central America a network of security agencies through the AID Public Safety Program and the CIA. They were linked by radio teletype. They exchanged information on dissidents across borders. In Guatemala, the unit was called La Regional. That was the beginning of the systematic military death squads. In the late 60s, in the provinces of Zacapa and Izabal, U.S. Green Berets actually went in. They assisted the Mano Blanca military death squads. The Mano Blanca death lists were compiled out of the embassy by a CIA employee by the name of Padilla. In 78, as the Lucas regime began gunning down civilians in the streets of Guatemala City, the U.S. arranged for a secret shipment of tanks to the regime via Belgium. Vernon Walters went in and said that praised the regime for embracing peace and liberty and constitutional institutions. Under Rios Montt in the early 80s, as they did the sweeps through the highlands, Reagan went down and said Guatemala was getting a bum rap on human rights. The CIA built for the G2 an intelligence training headquarters near the La Aurora airport. They put up a plaque thanking the CIA. Mm. The U.S. sent in operatives like Joe Jaccarino and Randy Capister, who actually went into the field with the G2 assassins. The U.S. was paying a multi-million-dollar subsidy year by year to the G2. They were carrying the G2 chiefs on their payroll. It goes on and on.
It's difficult not to sound naive to even say this, but it's extraordinary then that Donald Plante, the U.S. ambassador, could say, as he did on Friday to the New York Times, "I believe that the report's focus is appropriate, that these were abuses committed by Guatemalans against other Guatemalans, the result of an internal conflict."
internal in the same sense that the perhaps the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan was internal. The U.S. It would take an hour to sit here and list every dimension by which the U.S. Was backing this terror.
Now, this use of the word genocide, let's go back to that for a moment. Is this the first time that a U.N.-sponsored commission like this in these countries has talked about genocide, has used that term?
I don't know. They didn't use that term in Salvador, in the Salvadoran Truth Commission. It's obvious, though. In 82, as the army was wiping out by its own count 662 rural villages, the Catholic bishops of Guatemala issued a pastoral letter which called it genocide. Shortly thereafter, Ambassador Chapin, the U.S. ambassador, came out and said the massacres have stopped. Mm. Guatemala has come out of the darkness into the light, even as the massacres were intensifying. Prior to those sweeps being launched, Colonel George Maness, the U.S. military attaché, got together with Benedicto Lucas Garcia, the Army Chief of Staff, and helped plan the sweeps, helped plan the civil patrols. I know this because Maness told me. He boasted about it.
Well, we've only got a couple more minutes left. I'd like us to talk about what happens next, because we wouldn't want people to get the impression that the Mayans of Guatemala are living in safety, and what happens now with respect to the impunity of those who may come to be named as responsible for these crimes has everything to do with the condition of life in Guatemala and for them.
There have been some efforts by very brave Guatemalans to start to bring some officers to justice. For example, a case was filed following the massacre in Chaman, where they attempted to initiate criminal charges against Guatemalan officers. The case has been sidelined. At this moment, the military still has impunity. After the church's human rights Truth Commission report was released, Bishop Herardi last year was assassinated. There's strong evidence that points to the military. That investigation has been stalled. The G2 is still intact. The apparatus of the presidential general staff is still intact. They are there waiting, ready to strike. The guerrillas have been disarmed. The Guatemalan army is still there, and the U.S. is still backing that Guatemalan army.
And the U.S. gesture this time of handing over some of these private files, what do you think about that?
Well, it's kind of like if somebody comes into your house, kills your family, burns it down, and they take some notes and pictures. And then a few years later, you know, they come to you as you're still stunned and in mourning and say, oh, by the way, you want to see some of the notes? You want to see some of the photos? Well, thank you very much. You know, it's thanks is not the appropriate response. The appropriate response is prosecution.
And what can people do? Or is there anything happening here in the States that people can do to show that their attention is still focused?
Well, there's legislation in Congress being pushed by Amnesty International and others that would force full declassification of all the relevant documents, not just for Guatemala, but other countries in the region. There's the School of the Americas campaign to shut down one of the main training bases for the Latin American paramilitaries. General Gramajo, who was chief field commander for the rural sweeps and later minister of defense, whose men were involved in the gang rape and torture of Sister Diana Ortiz, shortly after a U.S. federal court found that he had planned a campaign of terror against civilians, School of the Americas invited him back to give the commencement address, and he's now in their Hall of Fame.
I'm going to bring you right back. We're going to take a 60-second break for stations to identify themselves. You're listening to Democracy Now!
There is no silence deep enough.
There is no silence deep enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No politician bent enough.
No politician bent enough.
To bury your story, to keep it from us.
Bury your story and
you're listening to Democracy Now! Your last comments, Alan Nairn, were on the situation with the School of the Americas. There are demonstrations coming up?
Yes, this spring in Washington, there'll be another mass rally to try to push congressional legislation to shut down the school. And then this coming November, there'll be, again, the massive vigil on the anniversary of the assassination of the Salvadoran Jesuits and their housekeeper and her daughter.
Alan Nairn, who is a reporter who's been covering the situation in Guatemala for more than the last decade. You can follow his work in The Nation and elsewhere. Thanks very much for being with us here on Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Amy Goodman, and we're going to move from brutality by security forces in Guatemala to the situation here right at home in the United States. New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman ousted the superintendent of the New Jersey State Police this weekend after a published report quoted him as saying that it was naive to think that race was not an issue in drug crimes and that marijuana traffickers were more likely to be members of ethnic minorities. In an article published by the Star-Ledger of Newark, Colonel Carl A. Williams was also reported to have made a racial link between President Clinton's trip to Mexico to talk about the drug trade and the likelihood that drug traffickers belonged to ethnic minorities. Black state legislators, religious leaders, civil rights leaders, and others praised Whitman's decision to oust Williams. He'd been under fire for weeks over charges that New Jersey state troopers unfairly single out African Americans on state highways for traffic stops. And all this comes on the tail of last week's news conference held by civil rights leaders in New York calling for a federal investigation into police brutality in the broadest sense. The conference was sponsored by the National Urban League, and we're going to turn now to Hugh Price, head of the National Urban League, introducing that event in New York last week.
Good morning. My name is Hugh Price, president of the National Urban League. And we're here for a historic gathering of grassroots organizations, civil rights leaders, business leaders, and families from all races and all walks of life. We're enraged by the epidemic of police violence and abuse all across the United States. We're sickened by the killing of Amadou Diallo in New York City, Taisha Miller in Riverside, California, and Darren Grimmett in Pittsburgh. The National Urban League reached out to civil rights leaders, business leaders, and parents to join hands today for justice. And we've been absolutely overwhelmed by the response of leaders who wanted to come today to testify. It's a sheer sign of how outraged, how anguished, and how exasperated we all are. Make no mistake, it's also an indication of how determined we all are that the open season on minorities in this country must cease. The National Urban League has fought for racial harmony from the day we were founded 90 years ago. All across the country, the leaders of our Urban League affiliates, like Esther Bush of Pittsburgh and Don Bowen of Fort Lauderdale, who are here with us today, have worked in concert with the organizations who are here to try to help the victims' families and to try to restore peace after these police killings and abuse. We are all fed up with putting out fires set by police officers. Police abuse comes in many forms, some of which capture the headlines. We hear about the notorious and senseless killings at the hands of police. We read about the savage assaults on the Rodney Kings in L.A. and Abner Louimas in New York City. But it's also a fact that on turnpikes in New Jersey and Florida, black motorists are being targeted by state troopers. It's a fact that out in the Southwest, Latino American homeowners are being accosted by policemen in their own neighborhoods and in front of their own homes. And in their zeal to get the guns off of New York streets, the gung-ho Street Crimes Police Unit is stopping and frisking tens of thousands of young people who have done absolutely nothing wrong. Now, we know that the police have an incredibly difficult and dangerous job, and we believe that the vast majority of policemen want to do the right thing. But clearly, there are trigger-happy cops out there who are not fit to serve. And clearly, there are police departments across the country that have given their policemen license to ignore civil liberties. We want safe communities, but we surely have the right not to be preyed upon by those who are supposed to protect us. And despite all the constructive protest and peacemaking efforts, we see little sign that mayors and police chiefs who are obsessed with cutting crime have any intention of reining in their officers or respecting the civil liberties of minorities and the poor. This national epidemic of brutality and abuse cannot be solved case by case, outrage by outrage, after the fact. And that is why I wrote to President Clinton 1 week ago, imploring him to step up to the plate and provide leadership.
That was Hugh Price of the National Urban League. We're going to come right back to that press conference in just a minute.
500 FBI agents coming after us with a license to kill, 30 mil, claiming it's just a drug bust.
They thinking they're making a fly switch, the place for double for the witch.
Reach up and reach, not a reach, power to the people and the beat. Some people are accused, some people are crime, some people get away with losing my rhyme. They don't like where I'm coming from, so they play dumb. Dumb diggity dumb, diggity dumb. Well, I'm telling you what they do. Everybody plays a fool while the real keep cools in a pool.
Yeah.
He'll got the finger on the war button. Talking loud, ain't saying nothing. TV got him bigger than life. All he needs is a knife.
You're listening to a press conference sponsored by the National Urban League, broadcast here on Democracy Now. That was Hugh Price from the Urban League. Next up, we're going to hear from Esther Bush, who is head of the Pittsburgh chapter of the league. Esther Bush.
We all know that President Clinton cares passionately about racial harmony and that he views it as a centerpiece of his legacy. We know that the president dreams of the day when we're one America. But, Mr. President, America cannot get from here to there as long as police brutality and abuse tear our communities apart. And that is why we have called upon the president to convene a White House summit which places the national spotlight smack on this problem and presses key stakeholders like police, mayors, civil rights groups, and others to come up with solutions that reconcile our yearning for safety with the protection of civil liberties. Mr. President, we ask you to dispatch a blue ribbon panel of investigators armed with subpoena power to conduct public hearings across the country to ferret out evidence of police brutality and abuse. And if they find widespread evidence, as we are sure they will, this panel should devise guidelines for state and local police departments that cover the appropriate use of deadly force and prohibit detaining and searching people who have done nothing wrong and are not suspects in specific cases. And, Mr. President, and if there are police departments that repeatedly brutalize and abuse people, we urge you to take legal action to place these departments in federal receivership until they get their acts together. Mr. President, the very people who have stuck with you through thick and thin are the primary victims in this country of police brutality and abuse. They want you to address this constant threat to life, limb, and civil liberties, and they want you to address it up front and not after the fact. Mr. President, we seek a meeting with you to hear your personal commitment and your concrete plans to address this national crisis in law enforcement. Just last week, I was talking about the Amadou Diallo killing with a prominent African-American editor of a national business magazine. He told me that he and his wife are trying to raise their teenage son to respect and trust the police. But this father also told me that he's fearful every day his son leaves the house in the morning because he worries whether his son will have an uneventful day. He wonders whether a conscientious police officer will protect him from some danger. He worries whether some police officer will accost and frisk his son, and he worries, perish the thought, that someday his son may return home in a coffin. Mr. President, the anxious mothers and fathers of this nation await your leadership. And we have received a letter from the President this morning indicating that he has received our letter, that he is committed to working on the problem. We are expecting a response from him and a meeting with him and a direct action agenda by him. This is not a matter that can be handled by the Justice Department or one of the other departments of the federal government. We need presidential leadership. Just about 3 years ago, we held a press conference in this very room with the mother of Johnny Gamage, a young man who had been killed at the hands of the police in a suburb outside of Pittsburgh. We asked the president at that time to step up to the plate and provide national leadership. That hasn't happened. And sadly, we are back here in this room this very day, today with Esther Bush, who is the head of the Pittsburgh Urban League, and today with Mrs. Betty Grimmett, the mother of Darren Grimmett, another young man who was killed in Pittsburgh at the hands of the police. Let me ask Esther Bush and Betty Grimmett to join us at the stage. Esther?
Since 1995, there have been several high-profile deaths at the hands of police officers in the greater Pittsburgh area, including Johnny Gamage, Jerry Jackson, Darone Grimmett. And sadly, there are many others that are not so high-profile that have brought the same pain to the greater Pittsburgh community. As a result, too many Pittsburgh citizens, especially African Americans, view the police with fear and mistrust. And need I remind you that currently the city of Pittsburgh's police department is operating under a consent decree being monitored by the U.S. Department of Justice. Certainly, we are not indicting all police everywhere. We respect their position of responsibility that they hold and the difficult job that they must do. And make no mistake, we want them to do their jobs. Yet in cities like Pittsburgh, where a frightening pattern continues to emerge, questions must be asked, and we must take a hard and sobering look at the realities of police misconduct. No finger pointing, just addressing the facts in partnership with all who care about our quality of living. President Clinton, marches sponsored by the Urban League, the NAACP, rallies, protests, both in Pittsburgh and in Washington, D.C., holding candlelight vigils at churches and trying to make comments through the tears of the families that are present, printing thousands and thousands of brochures about what to do when a policeman stops you. Yet you don't know whether to print in the brochure if you should stop, if you should cooperate, if you shouldn't cooperate, because unfortunately we have examples of where deaths have ended in either situation. The Urban League of Pittsburgh has come to Washington four times over the last several years, three times dealing with the Gamages and today, all surrounding the issue of police brutality. Mr. President, I spoke with Mrs. Gamage last night. I'm sure you're aware that the Justice Department has closed the Gamage case, and they have stated that they have found insufficient evidence to move any further. Mrs. Gamage says she will continue to fight until she finds justice somewhere. We were in hopes that the Justice Department would bring that. Maybe you can bring that now through helping some of the other families. Mrs. Gamage finds no closure, and unfortunately, I am here today with Mrs. Betty Grimmett. who has personally felt the pain of what happened as a result of reckless policing. Mrs. Betty Grimmett's son, Daron Grimmett, is dead at age 32. We are hopeful that the justice system will work favorably for Mrs. Grimmett, her family, and other victims of police misconduct in the city of Pittsburgh and everywhere. Mr. President, we need your help now. Mrs. Grimmett?
Thank you, Esther. First and foremost, I would like to thank the Urban League for inviting me here to speak with you. I am here today to seek justice for my son, Daron Stephon Grimmett, Sr. Daron was killed unjustly at the hands of a Pittsburgh police officer, Jeffrey Cooperstein, on December 21, 1998. When most of the world's families were preparing for Christmas, my family was making funeral arrangements. While most children placed their father's gift under the tree, Daron Jr. placed his in the casket. My family nor Christmas will ever be the same. So I'm here today to extend a national plea to our president to investigate these cases and police misconduct and prosecute to the fullest extent the abusers. Mr. President, we have a police brutality problem in Pittsburgh, which is widely spreading throughout the streets of America. Police take an oath to protect and serve the citizens of our communities. They were not given a license to kill or to use unlawful deadly force unless their lives are in danger. In my son's case, this was not so. The evidence and the facts are so strong that they speak for themselves. Mr. President, this is a case of a police officer, Jeffrey Superstein, who took the law into his own hands for his own personal reasons to kill my son. Mr. President, in order to make the streets of America safe and to prevent citizens from becoming victims to police brutality, I ask that you review and change laws to include concise policies of police chases, consequences as deadly force is used, thorough background checks on police officers, criminal and civil records prior to hiring. Today, Mr. President, I speak on behalf of many families who have already experienced the death of a loved one at the hands of a police officer. Something is wrong. The killing must stop. It is my hope and continuous prayer that no other family would ever have to experience the tragic loss of a loved one to police brutality. Thank you. God bless.
One of the nation's most distinguished attorneys who has handled all too many of these cases is with us, the great Johnny Cochran.
Thank you very much, Hugh. I'm here today as a concerned citizen to say to the president and others who are in power, there is perhaps no greater issue in minority communities that galvanizes the community like the issue of excessive police force. I'm here today as one of the lawyers for the family of Taisha Miller out in Riverside, California, who was shot 27 times after her family called for the 911 just to stir her from inside of a car where her car had stalled. I'm here as a representative of the family of Amadou Diallo, who was shot 41 times by representatives of the Street Crimes Unit in New York. A policy of shoot first and investigate later. We're almost a month post that shooting, and no one has any answers, no official answer. Imagine if you had done this. This is a separate class we've created of police who have a motto of, we own the night. Well, they don't own the night. They're there to protect and to serve. This same unit, over a short period of time, the last year or so, has encountered and stopped 45,000 New Yorkers. 45,000, only 10,000 of which have been arrested in some form. Probably many of those cases were thrown out. Those other 35,000 people went on their way after this kind of unpleasant contact with this unit. We represent also the New Jersey Four, young men who were targeted as racial profiling. All of this really goes back really to racial profiling. Racial suspects, the usual suspects. I believe that you were involved in some nefarious activity by how you look. We've got to change those kind of attitudes. And then finally, the brutalization of Abner Louima. We represent Abner Louima. Brutalized beyond belief. But these cases that I mentioned to you now are the high-profile cases that get the attention. I'm concerned equally about the 35,000 who were let go in New York after being stopped by this unit. I'm concerned by the New Jersey Turnpike, where 100,000 people are stopped on that turnpike each year, and 75% of those are African Americans. Yet African Americans are only 12% of individuals who are driving. 12%. But yet 75% of those stopped by these officers because of racial profiling. It is illegal. So when the law enforcement officers engage in illegal conduct, it diminishes all of us and diminishes the system. When judges sit there and allow a fabricated probable cause to stop someone and look the other way in the interest of saying, well, gee, we're suppressing crime. It is not necessary to suppress crime to kill, mutilize, brutalize, maim innocent citizens. So, of course, this issue galvanizes all of us. And so today, we're here united to say that we care about this country. We want to believe in justice, but there is an erosion in the justice system and confidence in the system at all levels. We have created a situation where these police officers are elevated to a position above the law. When these events happen, no one talks to them, especially in New York. They have a 48-hour rule. No other citizen has that kind of right. Imagine shooting someone 41 times and nobody talks to you for 48 hours. And further, then the union representative who beats everybody else there says, we're not talking at all. Now, they have an absolute right not to talk, but at least let's try and find out what happened. This is a national emergency. It calls for immediate action.
Next, I would like to ask the Reverend Al Sharpton, who is the head of the National Action Network and who has provided such leadership in New York City to make certain that injustice stays on the frontal lobe and in front of all of us and is not vanished from our sight. Reverend Al Sharpton.
Thank you, Mr. Price. Certainly, I'm happy to join this call for the president to personally deal with this issue. I come today with Reverend Herbert Daughtry and Reverend W. Franklin Richardson and others. After just experiencing 3 weeks ago the shooting of Amadou Diallo, shot at 41 times, unarmed, no criminal record, no crime in progress. Mr. President, I went with his family to bury him in Guinea. I sat and talked with many people in Africa that talked about how your visit to Africa had raised such hope and had, in many ways, inspired a new relationship between the continent of Africa and these United States. Yet those 41 bullets undercut what impact your visit made, because as we drove 9 hours from Conakry, Guinea, to the village of Amadou Diallo, children lined the streets, pointing at his coffin, saying, why did he die? There is no reason. Well, who killed him? Policemen did. Well, what happened to the police? Nothing. How can we tell people around the world to come to America to fulfill their dreams, send them home in caskets, no one even to explain the reason, and our president who visits their country cannot give direct attention to a growing problem? I remind you, Mr. President, in 1992, when you ran for president the first time, this nation was coming to grips with the Rodney King case, and many of the candidates promised to deal with police brutality. It is 1999. It has not been dealt with. We are asking you to fulfill the commitments of 92 by giving your personal attention to this problem. We are asking it, as Mr. Price has said, with nonviolent marches and protesters and protesting and organizing. We do not want to see mass violence occur to have to get White House attention on a growing problem. I remind you in the media that many of us came to Washington when this scandal was going on to say that we did not want to see the law used for political reasons to protect those that wanted to take a shot at the president. And our community stood on that. It was not Jesse Helms, it was Jesse Jackson to help galvanize this country around that issue. We come back to Washington on the same principle, saying that those that are hired to protect the law should not be above the law. All police are not bad, but those that are, we need to have punished. We're asking the president to personally intervene. We talk a lot about John Kennedy. John Kennedy met with civil rights leaders directly on the issues of that day. Lyndon Johnson met with civil rights leaders directly to deal with the issues of that day. We need you, Mr. Clinton, to meet directly with civil rights leaders on a growing national crisis of police misconduct and police brutality.
That was Reverend Al Sharpton speaking at a national press conference held last week by the National Urban League, calling for a national investigation into police brutality. We're going to have some final closing comments by Kwesi Mfume and others in just a moment. You're listening to Democracy Now!
It started in slave ships.
Slave ships. There are more records of slave ships than one would dream. It seems inconceivable until you reflect that for 200 years ships sailed carrying cargo of slaves.
Non-violent. In the face of the violence that we've been experiencing for the past 400 years, is actually doing our people a disservice. In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums!
This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Sitting in for Amy Goodman, I'm Laura Flanders, and we've been listening to a report from the National Urban League, who held a press conference on police brutality here in New York last weekend. The conference was coordinated by Hugh Price, head of the National Urban League. Coming up, you're going to hear speakers Kwesi Mfume, Abe Foxman, and others. You're listening to Democracy Now!
Throughout this century, the NAACP has been in the forefront of fighting for justice, fighting against lynching, fighting against police brutality, and we are delighted that Kwesi Mfume, the distinguished president and CEO of the NAACP, who is leading this fight across the country on this issue, is here with us today. Kwesi.
Thank you very much. The NAACP is happy and honored to have the occasion to join with our sister organization, the Urban League, and with all of the men and women who are here representing, respectively, organizations, initiatives, and movements across this country on this very important issue. This is, for all intents and purposes, a national crisis. A national crisis in law enforcement that continues, regrettably, to go unabated. Several years ago, the NAACP, joining with Harvard University, put together Beyond Rodney King, a compilation of the facts of what's happening with respect to police brutality across this nation. We did that then, and we do so now, to call America's attention back to some of the shame and some of the utter disrespect for life that's occurring in the streets all across this country. We have sat in, slept in, stood in, studied in, and prayed in. We've waged this struggle nonviolently and appealed to the nation's morality and the nation's conscience. We seek proper redress of our grievances. We petition this government, both the President and the Congress, to move swiftly in that regard. The NAACP respects and appreciates and will defend the bravery and the dedication of those men and women who every day put on a uniform, put on a badge, take their jobs seriously, and go about the process of protecting our communities. The good men and women who get up every morning and kiss their families goodbye and then go out to work to protect our communities. Their job is to, as Mr. Cochran said, serve and protect. And those individuals take their jobs seriously. But the reason we have gathered under the umbrella of this national emergency is not because of them, but because of the others. The others who, for some reason, assume that they can take the law into their own hands, and the others, quite frankly, who do just that. And so their brutality and their disservice and their abuse of power is a gross injustice not only to the good men and women who protect us, it is a gross injustice to all of us and to the people that we represent all over this country, law-abiding citizens who have every right, just as the people who have come before me and who will come after me have said, to expect that their police departments will do the right thing. And so, 2 years ago, we marched here in Washington outside of the Justice Department. Most of you in this room were not there to report that. No one seemed to care about it. It went unheralded, in many respects unnoticed. But several hundreds of us marched to underscore then, 2 years ago, with respect to the Gamage case, what we plan to do again, and that is to never cease drawing attention to this. And if the next march means civil disobedience and going to jail in large numbers to underscore our outrage at police brutality, then so be it. The NAACP calls on the president and calls on the Congress and governors, quite frankly, to do several things. We believe that the President of the United States and the Attorney General, at the very least, ought to move to quickly develop a process, if necessary, through presidential order, whereby federal law enforcement dollars will be withheld from police departments who have an unusually high number of police brutality complaints, or where there is a significant number of unresolved or pending complaints of brutality or excessive force. They ought not be receiving federal law enforcement dollars until there is an initiative on their part to deal with that. Secondly, we believe that states should work together, preferably through the Conference of Governors, to develop a set of uniform procedures and a process for the establishment of countywide and citywide police-civilian review boards for the initial adjudication of complaints of excessive force. And, however, all such boards should have both investigatory and subpoena power. We believe that police unions and mayors, instead of fighting against such a process, should instead work to be a part of its construction and work to be a part of its implementation. And thirdly, we call upon the Congress and congressional leaders of both parties, particularly the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader of the Senate, to make a vow to breathe new life into the 1994 Crime Control Act by providing the funds called for under that act to allow for the collection of comprehensive national data on the use of excessive force by police departments, including the data on the number of people killed or injured by police shootings or other types of force. The AG under that act was required to collect such data. Congress has yet to fund it. And so we expect, quite frankly, not just hope for, we expect that the congressional leadership will also step forward on this very important issue. And finally, let me say this. The streets of our nation are being watered, not with rain or debris, but they're being watered and littered and cluttered with the tears of the families of victims, the people who you've heard from and so many others who are not here, who have to bury their dead, who have to go on with unanswered questions, who have to raise children, and who have to somehow or another still muster enough respect to believe that police and policing in this country is a noble cause. Their tears water our streets. They cry out for some sort of relief and some sort of justice. And we can no longer simply assume that it will not be us, that it is someone else. These people are our citizens. They're our brothers and our sisters. Their anger, their pain, their hurt ought to at least be ours as well.
Thank you very much, Kweisi. The Anti-Defamation League has fought bigotry and intolerance throughout its existence. We're delighted that Abe Foxman, the president of the Anti-Defamation League, is here with us.
Thank you, Hugh. Sometimes prophetic vision brings us together. Sometimes it's shared historical memory. Today, as you've just heard, tears bring us together. Tragedy, pain, and anguish, not of the past, not historical, but of yesterday, last year, or 2.5 years ago. The Anti-Defamation League supports a call for a swift investigation of recent incidents of apparent police brutality or excessive use of deadly force. It is so ironic, as well as tragic, that such incidents have involved possibly racist and unprofessional police conduct against members of minority groups. Ironically, because it is most often those very minorities who are the victims of violent scapegoating, discrimination, and sometimes crimes, and who most need and deserve the full protection of our laws and constitutional guarantees of equal treatment.
Let me conclude by asking one of the great leaders of this country, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who has fought this good fight on so many fronts for so many years, to bring this press conference to a close. The Reverend Jesse Jackson.
I'm concerned that we focus today on the climate setters for the police behavior. Last year, race dialogue. Today, race reality and race violence. I'm not sure that this is the center of American life, and therefore should absorb our energies in ways we become paralyzed in our quest for equal protection under the law across the board. But those police who know of this behavior betray the credibility of their departments, the blue codes of silence that must be broken. We are called for healing, and we want healing. But there can be no healing until the glass is taken out of the wound. When Rosa Parks was arrested in 1955, one reaction was to attack bus drivers or to seek to get for her an apology from the mayor. He says there's a bigger question than a bus driver and a mayor, the bigger question of public accommodations and equal protection under the law. It's a 9-year struggle from 55 to 64 about raising the right question. Today, the Department of Justice is on trial. There's too much silence and passivity from the Department of Justice. The only face we see on justice is Ken Starr. We once could turn to Robert Kennedy, or could turn to Ramsey Clark. Justice had a face on it. Today, justice is writing memos and running privatized investigations. The Attorney General must go to scenes of crimes and take a position for that which is right and good and fair. Justice must at least define the issues and serve as a deterrent and a detergent to a very toxic atmosphere. The Department of Justice, the area of police brutality and violence, needs more funding. Concern about the climate setters as we seek to meet with the President, Mfumi, Reverend Lowry, because it starts with those in blue suits on Capitol Hill who marginalize black life, who set traps for the black and the poor with unfair laws and use their considerable credibility to popularize time and crime that do not correspond. And so those in the blue suits on the hill write laws. The result in 2 million Americans in jail, slightly over a million, or 55% are African American. It starts at that level, the leaders of the country. What's wrong with that picture? 85% of all rural arrests are white. 75% of all rural arrests are white. Urban arrests are white. 55% of all those in jail are black. If you're targeted and don't have adequate legal support, you go to jail or death row, whether you're guilty or not. 5 grams of crack cocaine, 5 sweet and low sugar bags, 5 years mandatory, 500 grams of powder, probation. the Attorney General will not, in fact, fight to make that a one-to-one ratio. At least those who bring it in ought to bear more responsibility than those who get trap peddling. $40,000 worth of marijuana, the drug of preferred use on major campuses, probation, about 2 acres worth. $40,000 worth of powder, $8,000 worth of powder, 5 years mandatory. $29 worth of crack, 5 years mandatory. And so in New York, way before it got to Diallo being killed, they began to shift the budgets of housing for the poor to build jails in upstate New York as a trade-off for votes. The result is half of all public housing built the last 10 years have been jail cells. Urban housing for the poor is now a rural economic development plan in most cities across our country. In New York, $9,000 a year to educate the youth, $99,000 to put the youth in jail. I believe that Mr. Giuliani's behavior had been that from Mississippi, Alabama, the media would have dealt with him differently. He led a riot on City Hall when Dinkins was mayor. Reverend Sharp and I went to police headquarters at 30th Precinct in Harlem. 30 police, all white, indicted for dealing drugs in Harlem. The police station was the drug distribution center. Luema rammed in the rectum to the point of death in police custody in New York. So Diallo is not as another boxcar on a long train of abuses. If this had been George Wallace, if this had been some southerner door-blocking governor, the media would not have been so tolerant of such leadership coming from the top, like priests, like people. And so it's New York. It's not Mississippi. It's New York. It's a young man cleaning windshields in Chicago, squeegee. Police shot him point-blank range and blew his brains out. It is Rodney King, but don't stop there. The demonstration this Saturday in Riverside, California, young woman, Tyesha Miller, coming home at night, had a flat tire. Young man, white man, stopped and helped her, a Samaritan. He led her to the service station. He was so generous until she allowed him to take her nephew home, and he did. Her mother's epileptic, and so was she. She called her cousins. They called 911 for emergency relief. The police intercepted the call. She was lying in the car, windows closed. They said they saw a gun. She couldn't have been using it. The windows were up, and she called for emergency help. They broke out the windows and shot 27 times. All shots landed in the back. This is terrorism of the highest order. It starts with the marginalization of black life on that hill. And so it must start at that level. The 94 Criminalization Act, they're now trying to enforce and expand it next year. We must fight. When we march, Ron, march on the next bill that's supposed to be worse than this bill, led by some Democrats in the Senate who must be made accountable, not the least of which, one comes from New York. We must redraw the line, demanding fairness and equal protection under the law. So justice is too silent.
Shut them down. That was the Reverend Jesse Jackson speaking at a National Urban League press conference held in New York last week, sparked by the killing of Amadou Diallo, the man from Guinea who was shot 19 times by New York's Street Crimes Unit. That broadcast comes to you courtesy of Democracy Now! For a copy of today's show, please call the following toll-free number. That's 1-800-735-0230, 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. From the studios of WBAI in New York, sitting in for Amy Goodman, I'm Laura Flanders, and thank you for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!